Hi, folks. Andrew here. Before we get started with the pod proper, just wanted to say a couple things. You might notice over the course of the conversation that Mike and I have that we didn't really bring up, you know, anything that happened in Game 6, you know, notably the very controversial and very bad decision to disallow the goal that Nashville scored early in the second period, Colton Sissons. You know, that was... It was a bad play, or it was a bad call. You know, I can't believe that the referee, you know, wasn't behind the net. It wasn't really that much of a fast developing play. He should have been in position, and he simply wasn't. You know, it's unexcusable. You know, I don't think either of us necessarily have anything positive to say about NHL officiating at large. You know, but so please don't mistake our silence on the matter for, you know, condoning it. You know, I think we're probably going to, at some point this summer, sit down and have a nice long talk about just how, you know, some of the things going on with the NHL and how we could maybe make them better. You know, I think a large part of that is going to start with refereeing. So, you know, with that said, you know, we just don't typically get into kind of granular plays such as that. You know, it's not like it's going to change anything at this point to have a discussion about it. So, with that said, we hope you'll enjoy the show.
Welcome back to the Reggie's House podcast. My name is Mike Swanson, and I'm joined, as always, by my good friend and co-host, Andrew Roman. Andrew, how are you today?
I'm wonderful. What could be better? Penguins are Stanley Cup champs.
Preach, Pastor. It's it is a good day to be a Penguins fan.
How are you doing?
Honestly, you know, this... I'm excited. I'll be honest with you. I'm very excited about it. But this feels a little more surreal than it did last year. You know, last year they came in with this incredible wave of emotion and energy. And this one kind of feels exhausted, and it's more of a relief than it is like getting to the top of the mountain, so to speak.
Yeah, no, I think that's a, you know, a very good way of putting it. You know, I think the Pens last year, they were very much sort of a team of, you know, inevitability or something along those lines. You know, they were just so overwhelming all the time that it was just kind of like, all right, you know, just keep churning out these games, we'll get there eventually.
Yeah.
You know, whereas like this time it really, you know, you kind of had that kind of excitement and thrill, like, man, I don't know what's going to happen in this game. I don't know what's going to happen in this series.
And yeah. It was definitely a really strange thing to go about this year, because I think for the first time during the Senators series, when they lost game six, I guess it was, you know, I prepared for the first time in a while for this team to not win the Stanley Cup.
Yes.
and they won game seven, and it was a pleasant surprise, as opposed to being, you know, this expectation that they did it. So I remember going into the series, the cup final, just thinking, you know what, like, they're here and that's great, but if they win, cool. If not, I'm not surprised.
Well, exactly. You know, and I think that's the other nice thing about, you know, having won last year as well, is just like, you know, yeah, I wanted the Pens to win, but like, I would have been probably more than okay if Nashville had won. You know, I mean, maybe not so much with Ottawa, but
sure.
You know, but there's certain teams along the way, and it's like, you know what, whatever. Like, you know, Pens have set out and accomplished what they needed to do last year. If they do it again, it's just, you know, you're just playing with house money, basically.
Yeah, I mean, and let's just talk about it in case, if you're listening to this and you don't know the storied history. I mean, this is the first team in 19 years to repeat a Stanley Cup championship. The last team to do it was the 98 Red Wings. And if you're not familiar with that team, I did a little research before we, you know, as we were kind of prepping this episode. And I was looking through it, and that team had quite literally 7 Hall of Famers on it of the 29 contracts.
That's absurd.
It is absurd. So that means of the, you know, the active 19 skaters, 7 of them, almost half of them, are Hall of Fame inductees, not like already in the Hall of Fame. So that just kind of gives you a little bit of some context as to how to compare this Pens team to great teams of years past.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think, you know, for reference, it's like, you know, the whole point of doing this salary cap and having league parity now is that, like, you're not supposed to be able to amass that much talent. And I'm not saying that the Penguins do have that much talent. That's kind of just it. It's like, you know, what they were able to accomplish with this particular roster is just, I mean, it's stunning.
Yeah, I mean, it honestly is. And I have to keep reminding myself that the best team in the NHL does not always win the Stanley Cup. In fact, rarely does the best team in the NHL win the Stanley Cup. It just means that this team happened to beat four other teams in a best-of-seven series. And that's not to diminish the task, right? Like, it's not to make it seem like it's like, oh, this is just, you know, some punk trophy or something. No, it's, I think, the hardest trophy in sports to win. But, I mean, this team was banged up. It was beaten up. It was, you know, every superlative that you can think of in the book, and this team was that team this year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just thinking back on it, it was like kind of like, you know, last year, the 2016 team, like they had a few injuries down the stretch, but it was pretty much like everybody was back for the start of the playoffs. Whereas this year, obviously, you know, Chris Letang never returned to the lineup. That was one of the craziest stats that I saw, was that the Penguins are now this team is the first team in 25 years or something like that, or even longer, to win the Stanley Cup without a single defenseman having ever received a Norris vote.
That's astounding to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird because, like, I mean, I'm trying to think, like, on, I don't know, 2006 Carolina Hurricanes, what defenseman on that team ever earned a Norris Trophy vote? But I guess somebody did.
Who would it have been?
I don't know. I'd have to, like, look over their roster and see. Because there's probably, like, that one sneaky guy that was, like, you know, grizzled old veteran that maybe he wasn't even playing at that level when they won the Cup, but maybe 10 years prior he got, like, one random fifth-place vote for something.
Well, that's what I'm gonna look at. Who was on that team right now? Because I'm genuinely curious. Because I'm not gonna find. I'm not gonna find it.
But so,
I honestly don't know who it would have been. Like, I'm not even kidding you. Like, let me just run through the defensemen here: Anton Babchuk, Mike Commodore, Brett Hedekin, Andrew Hutchinson, Francisek Kaberle, Danny Richmond, Oleg Tvertsky, Nicholas Wallin, Aaron Ward, and Glenn Wesley.
Oh, wow. That's worse than I would have thought.
Yeah. it is. I honestly have no idea which person on this team. I mean, give you an idea of their highest scoring defenseman was Francisek Kaberle, who had 13 points in 25 games. And was a -7. So that gives you an idea of, you know, what their defensemen were capable of.
Jeez.
So anyway, sorry, please continue. That was just...
No, it's okay. I honestly don't even remember exactly where I was going from there. But, you know, you know, the impact of not having Letang, I think, cannot be overstated. And the fact that the Pens were still able to overcome it. And throughout the playoffs, they were, you know, missing guys left and right. You know, guys who played such a huge role last year. Patrick Hornquist and Carl Hagelin, you know, along with some other guys. Namely, you know, Nick Menino, obviously, literally skating out with a broken leg to do his lap with the cup. Just to overcome all of that is, it's certainly, I mean, I'm not necessarily trying to push, you know, some sort of new soft skills agenda for this podcast, but, like, what this team accomplished is, in some respects, like, so much more unbelievable than last year.
Right. Well, and that's the thing is that, I mean, at various points throughout the playoffs, I think every line in defensive pairing stepped up and had that game. You know what I mean? Like, starting obviously with the Malkin and the Crosby units, I mean, you're always going to have those guys step up. But I mean, in game six in Nashville, Matt Cullen was had the highest time on ice for Penguins forwards.
I did know that. That was crazy.
Yeah, I mean, like it is crazy. I mean, almost 41 years old, and you know, is leading the charge for a team is in, you know, in a shutdown role. I mean, it just seems like, you know, this team, we headed into this playoff season saying this is not the most deep team, but it's the most balanced team. I mean, Evgeny Malkin played, I think, less than 14 minutes in game
six.
Yeah,
I know it wasn't a particularly high number. I think, you know, a few people were like, well, you know, why aren't they leaning on those guys a little bit more? And, you know, and I certainly understand that, but it was also like, I mean, a few kind of factors got in the way in terms of penalties and the Pens being on the kill a lot. You know, but it was also just like, I just felt like his line was kind of not getting it done yesterday.
Yeah, and that happens.
On Sunday night. And it's, I mean, it happens. So sometimes you just got to make a little bit of a change. I mean, he still ended up leading the postseason in scoring, 28 points. I read something today that said that was like, in the salary cap era, that's like the sixth highest total, which is surprising, especially because like those 07-08 and 08-09 Pens, like I feel like in both of those years, like both Sid and Gino went off. Like they both had like...
Yeah, well, they were 32 and 34 respectively, I think, or something like that.
Along those lines. Like when Gino did win his... Conn Smythe in 09, like he, right. Like that was obviously the high water mark, but I'm pretty sure it was 34 points that year.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it just goes to show you that I think you had contributions from up and down the ice. There was, I don't know, it's just a heck of an impressive feat to me, no matter which way you look at it.
Absolutely. You know, and a lot of credit to the organization for, for trusting in a guy like Jim Rutherford to actually do the right thing, which has certainly panned out immeasurably. I mean, all of a sudden, it's like, man, this guy might be one of the, you know, great team builders of all time.
Right. Well, I mean, gone are the days in when, you know, he's forced to play five defensemen because, you know, he screwed up in managing the cap situation and call-ups and this, that, and the other thing. That was only, you know, 2 years ago when people were calling for him to be fired in his first season.
Exactly.
As GM.
You know, and I think that takes a lot for a GM to kind of recognize, like, you know, to be caught out in a spot like that, you know, kind of in a really bad situation. But then to also have an opportunity to, you know, make right and actually really get in there and analyze what's going on with this team and make the corrections.
Yeah. Yeah, well, let's keep going because there's a ton of stuff that we have to cover. We want to do just a few of the stat things that I think, you know, caught my eye, caught your eye as we were going, and then a look ahead to this dreaded expansion draft, which I think, if nothing else, will be one of the most entertaining things in the past 10 years NHL.
I'm like legitimately stoked for this. Like I kind of vaguely remember what happened, like when Minnesota and Columbus joined the league in 2000, it was not like what they're setting this up to be, and that's going to be a really neat thing.
No, not at all. Yeah. Well, do we want to stick with the Stanley Cup for now? We'll close out with the barn burner of this expansion draft.
Definitely.
Okay. Cool. Well, so here's a couple things that I wanted to talk with you about. So DK Pittsburgh Sports ran a fun little infographic. I don't know if you saw this, that over the past, just like the Pens numbers from the past 10 years, and essentially what they called the dominance of the Penguins over the past decade. So just real quick running through, they're tied for first in the number of cups that they've won with 3, they are first with a number of appearances and 4. Most playoff wins with 90, which is an absurd number. Most playoff games with 152, and most regular season wins with 467. Do any of those surprise you?
Not particularly. I mean, it's shocking just to think about, you know, again, like 3 years ago, it was, you know, people were writing the articles, well, this is the end. No more Crosby, Malkin, Penguins.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, we're going to have to make some dramatic changes. There's no way you can win with, like, a two superstar model, which, right. You know, now all of a sudden it's like, not only has that narrative been destroyed, but it's literally been, like, diced into, like, the tiniest microscopic pieces and like, fed to the wolves or whatever.
Right.
But, yeah, no, I mean, you know, just consistency. I mean, even in years where really the team probably wasn't that good, I mean, I feel like those stars have always been there to ensure that the wins stay high, that enthusiasm stays high. You know, just the overall, you know, the passion for the, like, in within the fan base is maintained, which then...
Yeah, well, I mean...
Well, and I was just going to say, and then that allows you to, you know, continue to spend to the cap. And if you have an injury to an expensive player, you can even spend over the cap with LTIR relief. You know, right. And that's so important.
Yeah, well, you know, just as I'm looking at it, I'm looking at this playoff wins. They're in first with 90, right? So if you average that out, it's 9 playoff wins every year, right? And I know it's not necessarily wise to look at it that way, but... That means that they're averaging a conference final at least every year. Like, because you know what I mean? Like, you have to think of it in those terms. And, I mean, granted, like, there have been plenty of, like, burnouts and flameouts over the course of that time. But, man, I mean, this team has been really good for a really long time. And I just don't want to breeze past that. I don't want to breeze past the fact that, like, Pittsburgh has been home to exciting hockey for a really long time. Like, there's been meaningful hockey here for a long time. And I don't want to take that for granted when you look at, like, the futility of, like, the Oilers or the Vancouver Canucks or, God forbid, the New Jersey Devils. I mean, gosh, like, I can't imagine what it would be like to just year after year for, you know, 10 years, just come turn on a Pens game and just be like, you know what, like, there's a, you know, 2-3 shot that they don't win this game and they get blown out in the process.
Yeah, no, I mean, we're so fortunate, you know, and it's, you know, I don't think it's too hard for either of us necessarily to remember some of those dark days in the early 2000s. Captain Steve McKenna comes to mind instantly.
Gosh, those Rico are Fata, terrible teams.
Oh, Konstantin Koltsov.
Like, that name. Yeah. I remember after, you know, like, Peter Nedved and after he left and the team was just kind of like, you look around and you go, wow, who's going to play on this team? And the answer was, no one knows. Like, nobody has a good idea.
No, absolutely. And it's, you know, and, you know, unfortunately, I think there is a little bit of a reality that what we've learned is that, you know, that's a pretty good way to come back, though, sometimes, is that, you know, you just really have to tear it down to the, you know, to the absolute studs and just, you know, hope that you can get lucky, hope you can be in a position to draft some generational players. You know, I think, like, you brought up the Oilers earlier, and it's like, you know, you look at their rebuilding, and it was, and I think what made it so challenging is, like, yes, they kept getting the first overall pick, but it was guys that weren't, you know, I mean, certainly not a Sidney Crosby or an Evgeny Malkin type player, but also not even like, I mean, not even like a Ryan Johansson caliber player necessarily.
Right. It's third tier kind of guys.
I mean, you think about a guy like Ryan Nugent Hopkins, who's probably, if he's playing in the right situation, he's probably a third line center, and he was the number one overall pick.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and he's, I mean, to his credit, doesn't mean he's a bad hockey player. I mean, he's better than a lot of other people. But if you have to draft him, like, if he's the best available player, that's the curse of going first overall, is that you just have to take the best overall player.
And that's, you know, I think that's something that even looking at this year's draft class, which is kind of a down class compared to the last couple years, you know, and once again, it's like the Devils are sitting in that spot now and they're like, we don't know what we want to do because we're not really that in love with any of these guys necessarily.
Right. Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, I'm excited for that. I just got to hold my tongue though, because there's just so many things are going to happen between now and then. So let me ask you this. I want to get back to the cup. So we are stat nerds on Reggie's House podcast, and I just wanted to take a quick look at some things that are not even necessarily advanced stats kind of stuff. But just to compare last year's team to this year's team, and like kind of how these teams got it done. So I was looking at it. I saw it, there was some chart somewhere. I don't remember where it was that I saw, but it was a chart of the past 10 years, and the teams that won the Stanley Cup, the number of shots and the number of goals for and against. That's it. Just laid out in chart, really simple. So last year's Penguins, the 2016 Penguins won, they generated 34.5 shots per game and kept their opponent to 23 shots per game, which is an insane number. That's almost 60% of the shots.
I'd have to see like how that compares to like the Chicago teams, but that seems like that has to be the best mark since we've actually been tracking this kind of stuff.
I think it was top one or two. But by converse, like, so that team shot the puck an ungodly amount in limited chances, but they outscored the opposition 2.5-2, just across it. Okay, which is like, I mean, that just tells me that actually they had probably a little bit of a lower shooting percentage than, you know, you would expect. Now, on the opposite side of it, you have this year's team that got outshot 24-29 even, so only 45.5%. of the shots for, yet outscored the opposition 3.2-2.2. So scored 60% of the goals, but only shot 45% of the pucks. What?
That's absurd. I mean, that, you know,
it is.
I think anti-stats people want to look at this postseason and say, well, this is the year where we can finally say these stats don't work. They're all crap.
Right.
But I feel like that's really oversimplifying things because, and not to like just continually beat on like how great Sid and Gino are, but I mean, one of the key things and any stats nerd, any statistician will tell you is that like, you know, you're always going to have outliers that completely, you know, abandon like the scale in which you're operating on. And that's just, that right. is Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin and, you know, and even Phil Kessel to that matter, you know, those guys, you know, we kind of hit on this a couple weeks ago just saying, like, you know, the 90s Penguins, they could, you know, score at will and, you know, and they kind of didn't worry as much about shot quantity. You know, and that's fine if you have that kind of level of talent. And I think in this instance, right. you know, those three guys really just, you know, truly stepped up and made that happen for this year's team. And again, that's just what we have to keep in perspective.
Yeah, and it hurts me because I want to see the advanced stats community, like this analytic community, just come in and just ride in on the white horse and just trounce the old quote-unquote eye test. But then you look at things like, okay, so the Pens PDO, right? The metric essentially of puck luck. And their puck luck measured, so even, right? If you're not familiar, for PDO, even is essentially 100. It's a combination of goaltender save percentage and shooting percentage. The Pens finished with a 105.7, which to the stats community, you will see, okay, that's a very alarming number, an unsustainable number. And yet, as you looked at them, did it ever seem unsustainable to you?
No, I mean, it really didn't. You know, I think there were certain points. I think I even, like, kind of looked back at, like, during the course of Game 4 in particular, because that was maybe the one game, well, at least in the Cup Finals anyway, that it really looked like, you know, the Penguins are just, they're outplaying Nashville, but they're losing. And it, you know, and with each game that kind of played out like that, I mean, I think there was, you know, at least a couple in the Ottawa series as well. You just get a little bit nervous that, like, okay, maybe they're not going to be able to sustain this shooting percentage or whatever the case may be. You know, but then all of a sudden, very next game, you know, within the first minute and a half, you just have Justin Schultz just, you know, dropping bombs from the blue line. And it's like, okay, no, they're fine.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, it's really strange. It's really, it was just a very, very bizarre postseason, especially by, you know, Penn's hockey right. standards.
And it's kind of funny because, you know, on the converse side of that, you know, I don't know, and trust me, this is not like a jab at Marc-Andre Fleury, but I don't know that throughout the history of the Penguins, like you would always say like, oh man, this is such a stout, you know, stout goaltending performance. You know, mm-hmm. but I mean, Fleury was incredible when he was in the net. I mean, he racked up like a 924 save percentage, and then Matt Murray came in and, mm-hmm. and took over and, you know, led the way with a 930. You know, but even at that, I don't know that in a lot of instances either of those goalies truly looked like, you know, they were literally standing on their heads. They just looked like they were playing well.
Right, right. Yeah, and that's the other thing is that, you know, I mean, Fleury steals you maybe one or two games, but, I mean, you're going to have that if you play 25 games in the mm-hmm. postseason, right? But I didn't look at it and say, you know, this is the Yaroslav Halak of 2012 syndrome, where he just goes off and literally wins two series mm-hmm. single-handedly. Yeah, I just didn't see that happen. I just saw good, solid goaltending, and good, and a lot of times just good collapsing and preventative defense for, you know, from the team.
Well,
in
exactly,
front of
and I think you know that kind of gets to sort of the other dynamic that we're always talking about. You know, I know that if you look at expected goals models, that you know the Penguins didn't really look very favorable throughout much of this postseason. Like they looked pretty good in the Columbus series. For whatever reason, it seemed like that series they were picking up on the fact that, like, you know, Columbus was shooting just to shoot from wherever, and the Penguins were waiting until they had mm-hmm. you know grade A chances. So it seemed like the expected goals models still kind of favored the Penguins through that round. But then as like the rest of the postseason went on, they kind of started to taper off. At least in terms of expected goals, but I think that might just be a statement of, you know, we still have some work to do to kind of smooth out how expected goals works.
Right. Yeah. No, and I'm excited for that stat to continue to develop because I think it's a really helpful stat. I mean, it, I think, predicted to a T Columbus's collapse in the midseason. Yeah. But I'm excited for that to continue to develop. So let me ask you this, because, you know, without having direct access to players and personnel and whatnot, I think there's only so much speculation we can do about, you know, what won the Penguins the Stanley Cup. So if you had to pick one unsung hero or one unsung facet of this team to credit with part of this victory, who would it go to for you?
Well, I mean, I think to me it would come down to, you know, Mike Sullivan and his staff, truly. You know, I think that this is a team that, I mean, every game they had adjustments and, like, they were able to mm-hmm. create something new that the team they were playing against hadn't seen yet. And, I mean, that's a remarkable feat to accomplish. Like, that you just can't do that with, you know, a lot of kind of high-priced, highly individualized athletes. But, I mean, these guys just had right. this team constantly just, you know, ready to respond to whatever the opposition had to throw at them.
Yeah. Yeah, I think for me, I took a look at it this afternoon just because I wanted to see what was looking or what happened with the penalty kill. And overall, it was a very middle-of-the-pack postseason for the penalty kill. In fact, I think they finished 9 out of 16 in terms of the actual percentage. But I looked at specifically, like the two big series for me, for the penalty kill was the Washington series, and the Nashville series, because those are two of the better power play units in the NHL, and combined Washington and Nashville went 5 for 44 on wow. the power play, so just an absurd amount of work, almost 89% on the kill, against two of the better teams in the whole NHL. And so I'm not going to sit here and say that, like, you know, the penalty kill was perfect. I don't think it was. It was actually quite horrendous in the Ottawa series. It was like Ottawa went 6 for 15 wow. or something like that, or 5 for 16. Yeah, it was significantly worse than I remembered. But when I look at what the kind of timely the opportunity in terms of the kills were, I mean, you have holding Nashville 0 for 4 in Game 6. You know, that has to go down as one of the biggest penalty kill performances in recent memory, you know, including a 1:35 5-on-3 power play. That's incredible. And I think, you know, that was one thing you just didn't hear get a whole lot of press, but they came up with the big stops when they needed to. And I think that's what the playoffs are all about, is getting the big stops when you need them to be. The case in point, Pekka Rinne versus Matt Murray. Matt Murray made the big stops when he needed to, and Pekka Rinne didn't. And that's why the Pens have a Stanley Cup and Nashville doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot to be said about all of that. You know, I think we tend to value within the stats community, you know, we say, well, you know, teams that are very strong with puck possession, very strong in Corsi during the regular season, have historically fared better in the postseason. And similarly, you know, if you're outchancing your opponent in the playoffs, that typically, surprise, surprise, that leads to better success. You know, but I also think that it's important to kind of also visualize the playoffs as being like a continuous series of small sample sizes. And you know, so sometimes it's like, yeah, maybe, you know, from one series to the next, like things aren't going to go quite as well or aren't going to go quite as smoothly. But it's just like being able to adapt in within that confine is what's so imperative to being able to win the Stanley Cup. And that's exactly what the Pens did this year.
Yeah, it was, I mean, I don't know, man. I'm still very elated. I'm bouncing back and forth between just being thrilled and excited that the Pens won another Stanley Cup, and like deeply analytical, because that's just how I work, and trying to figure out how do they do it. And then I scratch my head and just go back, and it doesn't matter. They won another Stanley Cup.
Well, I think, you know, again, it's not so much, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say like, oh, all, you know, analytics is dead. As long as you have a Sidney Crosby or an Evgeny Malkin, you can always win. Because we clearly know that that's not the case. You know, I think the Penguins spent a lot of years kind of ignoring some of that external, you know, some of the external developments regarding stats and regarding possession. And it, you know, they paid a pretty dear price. You know, it really did almost come down to them completely destroying, you know, this beautiful thing that they had created. But, you know, but luckily they've kind of found, you know, a coaching staff that actually appreciates and understands process versus results, and also, you know, and beyond understanding it, like they know what variables they have control over, you know, and to me, that's just like, I mean, it's not something you see often enough in professional sports. All of these incredibly, you know, incredibly high paid front offices and coaches and, you know, trainers and off-ice staff, and so few times you actually see a business kind of, or, you know, a company actually operating in an, or a team, I'm stuck in business mode, sorry, you know, actually operating at an efficient and effective level. But I feel like that's what the Penguins,
it's tough to maintain.
I mean, and I think the challenge will only grow for the Penguins now. You know, certainly, we still haven't had like our discussion on on Jason Botterill. Maybe we'll save that for next time. But you know, certainly, I think losing him is not gonna make things easier. And you know, the other side of it is, whereas the Penguins didn't have a lot of hard decisions last year to make after winning the Cup, this year they have quite a few.
Well, and let's. I mean, I guess we might as well take a look at that now, because I mean, the next question is, you know, after last season, it was okay, can the Pens repeat this? And the answer with a very emphatic yes, yes, they can repeat this. So I think, I mean, the next wise question is to ask, can they three-peat it? And that's a much trickier question to answer than it was last year. So just taking a look at real quickly here, the number of folks that are potentially moving. So you have potentially Matt, and we'll come back to this, but potentially Matt Cullen retiring. Chris Kunitz is a UFA and is 37. Nick Bonino is a UFA. Trevor Daly is a UFA. Ron Hainsey is a UFA. Mark Streit is a UFA. Chad Ruedel is a UFA. And then you've got RFAs, Josh Archibald, Connor Sheary, Oscar Sundquist, Brian Dumoulin in quote-unquote Jeff Schultz. I don't know if you know that reference, but Justin Schultz is also an RFA. So that is potentially a ton of turnover. Where do we start?
Well, I mean, I think those first two guys in some ways kind of go hand in hand. You know, I think they're both in some ways, well, I don't know how I want to exactly say this. I mean, I feel like, I'll get this out of the way first. I think Matt Cullen is done. I mean, multiple outlets were running reports yesterday on Sunday, like before the game, that, you know, he was very heavily considering what was going to happen next. And so that just kind of feels like, you know, somebody told these outlets, like, hey, you should run a story on him because he's going to retire. You know, and obviously that's a big gap to fill. You know, as you mentioned earlier, right, like he played more than any other forward in the Stanley Cup clinching game. And I feel like it was almost, you know, it was a borderline virtuoso performance. You know, I think a lot of people will get kind of grumpy that, like, you know, anybody can kill penalties, or, you know, if you work on it a little bit, you can.
Which is not true.
You can become good at face-offs. But, like, that is not the case. I completely agree. You know, and what he was able to contribute was a huge factor, especially with Nick Bonino out of the lineup, you know, who you used to kind of be able to share those duties with.
Right.
And I think just quickly on Kunitz, it's like, I mean, man, like, if this is it for him, because I certainly believe that retirement is an option for him as well. Man, what a way to go. 9 points in his last 7 games.
Yeah.
That unbelievable double overtime game clincher against Ottawa.
Right.
You know, he's a 4-time cup winner, 250 goals. I mean, I'm not saying he's a Hall of Famer, but he was also completely undrafted out of college and went on to do all of that. Gold medalist.
I'm sorry. I love Chris Kunitz and have, you know, since he came over in 2009. But he is easily the most competent bum of all time. Like, I mean, this is a guy who, you know, put up nearly 40 goals for a couple seasons. He's a good hockey player.
It's so rare when you see, like, a guy who, to use maybe a slightly more tactful term, like a, you know, like a true, like, middle six winger who can produce at right. such a high level and who therefore sticks with a team for so long. You know, I mean, we're basically going on a decade of Chris Kunitz.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I don't think he's that dissimilar from another player named P.A. Parenteau. And you see kind of that plight of what it looks like for that middle six winger just to bounce around again and again and again because everybody takes 20 goal scorers for granted. But for some reason, Chris Kunitz is stuck, and, you know, he's made a heck of a name for himself. I mean, I don't think there's going to be a lot of people that were hockey fans over this past decade that would say, Chris Kunitz who?
No.
You know?
No, not at all.
He's been an integral part of this team for a really long time, dating back to the Pens Cup in 2009.
Yeah. I mean, what else kind of can you say? I mean, he's just, you know, I don't know that you can ever view him as part of that core group. You know, considering the core of Sid, Gino, Chris Letang, and Fleury. But boy, he's right there with them. I mean, he's the only other guy that survived that whole time frame.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess the point that I do want to bring up is, like, I do almost wonder if Kunitz could almost take the Cullen route for another year or two. You know, maybe just say, you know, so he's coming off a contract that paid him like $3.8 million a season. Maybe he'll say, well, you know, give me 1.5 and I'll come back for a year. And then if that goes well, I'll come back for another year. You know, and I could definitely see that happening. And he's been a pretty productive possession driver, even away from Sid and Gino in the kind of limited time that he's done that. So, you know, that seems like a move that I'd be comfortable with.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think, I don't think that would be a bad option. I also could see him very much just saying, I'm going out on top. I think if I'm Matt Cullen, I think I'm pretty, like, I mean, it's kind of hard to have a better twilight to your career than to come in, win 2 Stanley Cups, play 19 and a half minutes, and, you know, go out on top like that. And I think those guys are proud guys, and I think that there's a real strong chance that they just choose to say, you know what, like, maybe I do have another year or two left in the tank, but at the risk of just being like, you know, kind of just like fizzling out and going the Sergei Gonchar route where, you know, you're on PTOs and nobody wants to pick you up. I think those guys are too proud for that. You know, I'd sooner see them retire than, trying to scrape by and on a, you know, $650,000 contract.
Yeah, no, I agree. You know, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens there. But so kind of moving on from those two, I do feel like, well, I'm going to knock these guys out of the way real quick. I don't foresee, with the possible exception of Chad Ruedel, I don't see any of those four defensemen we mentioned, Daly, Hainsey, Strait, and Ruedel, coming back.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, man. I liked Chad Ruedel. He was a good third-pairing guy. He's got a good shot. He scored, what, two slappers from the point? Like, he's not a bad defenseman. It was a solid pickup. But I don't see Daly and Hainsey and Strait. I think Strait retires after this year. I think Daly is going to be plucked by some team. Somebody will throw him some money. And the same thing with Ron Hainsey.
Exactly. I think Hainsey in particular might even just like literally go back to Carolina. Like, I could definitely see that happening. It's another, you know, kind of young up and coming team that maybe he can, you know, be a part of and be a factor on. I agree with Daly. I think he's going to get much more money from someone else, and, you know, that's okay by me. I mean,
it doesn't mean that, you know, there's no hard feelings or ill will there. It's just the simple fact that somebody's going to try to throw $4.5 or $5 million at him, just like San Jose did to Paul Martin. And that's okay. You know, that's part of the game. It's a business as much as it is entertainment.
You know, and I think some of the things that Daly does well, are definitely going to conflate his value. But, you know, I think it's also imperative to remember that, like, overall, he's not great at defending his own zone. I think that's kind of enough said about that. But I do think Nick Bonino kind of represents a little bit of an interesting piece. I'm not really sure what the Pens are going to do. You know, assuming that Cullen retires, and if Bonino were to walk in free agency, there's not a whole lot of options out there, like in free agency, to get a couple of centers.
Well, it's true, but I mean, we don't necessarily have to look outside to free agency to at least put a stopgap in there. Carter Rowney did a very admirable job as that fourth line center for the past, you know, couple games while Nick Bonino was out.
I don't disagree with that, but I'm also not convinced that Rowney might not be, you know, better served as a, you know, on the wing or just in that kind of 13th forward role where he can kind of, you know, come in and play whatever position is needed of him. Because it seems like, you know, and it's tough, especially with a guy like Rowney who's a very old rookie or very old first-year player. You know, it doesn't seem like he maybe has that fully developed, like, offensive skill set. I mean, he brings a lot of things, but, you know, I think if I'm the Penguins, I'm committed to returning to trying to be, you know, a puck-possessive team for next year. And I don't know that Rowney necessarily delivers that.
Well, and I think this provides a really interesting segue into, this is, I think, where it kind of merges into the expansion draft, because, I mean, so for the Penguins, you have Chris Kunitz coming off the books, and that's $3.8 million, and we will certainly circle back around to this, but Marc-Andre Fleury, it looks like, has played his last game in a Penguins uniform, and that's $5.75 million. The ghost of Rob Scuderi's $1 million contract comes off the books this year. So that's, I mean, that right there is $11 million in cap space that they're going to have. And depending on who gets scooped up by the expansion draft, you're going to have, you know, potentially even a lot more than that, even with, you know, signing some new contracts for guys like, you know, Justin Schultz and maybe one or two of these other RFAs. But the Pens have some money to play with, especially considering, you know, a guy like Trevor Daly, who's at, what, you know, $3.5 million or something like that?
Yeah.
Comes off the books.
I think he was 3.3, so that's definite savings.
So, I mean, you know, there's, I mean, the Pens are going to have probably more cap space than they've had in a really long time, with some more talented players waiting in the wings for the chance to jump up and play. And so, you know, they have room to move, which is, I think, that's a new feeling in Pittsburgh. We haven't had this in
and,
a while.
You know, and it is very weird, you know, especially coming off of last year where it was like, all right, this is kind of boring. Like, how about you just make a trade?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm not saying this is a smart decision, but do something.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, I think depending on who gets claimed by the expansion draft, the Pens could have upwards of $15 million in cap space to spend, which, dang, that's, I mean, you realize that reshuffles a lot of cards going into next year.
You know, I think we're going to loop around to this after the expansion draft and getting ready for the entry draft and free agency. But, you know, I'm kind of the mind that I think the Penguins can be and will be very interested in a guy like Kevin Shattenkirk. Just because, I mean, obviously.
I don't know how I feel about that.
Well, and we'll get into it at a later date. You know, but I feel like he certainly is one of the only meaningful and worthwhile pieces out there. You know, so I mean we'll see what happens. But let's stay let's keep looking inward for now.
Sure. So let's take a look at do we want to do Marc-Andre Fleury or do we want to do the expansion draft? Because I feel like they go pretty well hand in hand.
Well, I mean I think we should start with Marc-Andre Fleury. So apparently as reported by Renaud Lavoie of RDS in Quebec province up in Canada. Fleury has already, as of actually February, he had agreed to waive his no movement clause, which would make him eligible to go to Las Vegas if they wanted him, or the Pens could presumably pursue other trade options. I mean, he always only had a limited no trade clause, so technically they could have traded him if they found a willing partner.
Right.
But now it certainly seems as though, you know, he's kind of ready to move on, perhaps. You know, I think he was a bit, I can understand the disappointment and frustration that, you know, after one bad period, basically, after like an almost flawless postseason to that point, he lost the job to Matt Murray and never got it back. You know, and I certainly think that Fleury is a fairly good, selfless guy that's like, you know what, I appreciate the guys in Pittsburgh and I want to see them continue to do well, and I think maybe they can do better with Matt Murray as the goaltender of the future. So, you know, it seems like something's going to happen with Fleury this offseason.
Yeah, I mean, we've speculated before that he could wind up basically in any Canadian city going forward, and maybe a few other teams around the league. I would love to see him end up somewhere that is not Las Vegas, just because I don't want to see him struggle through the rebuild again. You know, I mean, I love, like, Marc-Andre Fleury is great. He's going to be, for me, in many cases, the face of the goaltending in Pittsburgh for the rest of my life.
Oh, definitely.
But, man, he got beat up the first couple of years he was in the league. I mean, he just got shelled from, I guess, what, 2003 through 2006. Yeah. Man, I feel bad for him, you know? I mean, especially coming in as like a 19-year-old kid. I just don't want to see him go through
exactly.
that again.
And
but maybe, you know, maybe he wants to. Maybe that's, you know, he's saying, like, okay, you know, they ran out of space for me in Pittsburgh. Like, time to show you guys, like, you know, what I'm about. And, I still haven't lost it. In fact, I'm just getting better. I don't know.
Yeah. Although, you know, to me, like, and I feel like I've even noticed this in some of the things that you kind of shared in your notes, Mike, that we'll get into more depth in a moment. But, you know, I can't necessarily understand exactly what Vegas's allure to having Fleury would be. There's a thing, Greg Wyshynski kind of talked about it often on the various podcasts that he does, but he basically hates Corey Schneider because he's too good and it keeps the New Jersey Devils from ever actually reaching like the very bottom. And
right.
Well, no, they didn't need it this year. They got a little bit lucky, but you know, again, it's like they get to not, you know, but it's a year too late is basically what it comes down to. You know, if they had moved on from Schneider a couple years ago, they could have maybe been in the running for McDavid or Eichel or Matthews or Laine.
Right.
And instead they're going to get Nico Hischier or somebody like that. You know, right. And I kind of feel like that could be the same situation in Las Vegas. You know, I think Fleury is good enough that he's going to probably give them an unfair point share when he's playing that might prevent them from being able to get those top picks that they're going to need to actually be able to build a good team.
Right. Right. Well, and are they going to be in the Pacific
Division?
Yes, they
will.
Do we know? Okay. Well, that's one of the weaker divisions in the NHL. Like, you know, it would not be far off to see them, you know, in the middle of that division come the end of next season if a goaltender like Marc-Andre Fleury ends up there who can steal you maybe, you know, 5-6 games throughout the regular season and gives you a fighting chance night after night. You know, who can also play 65 games. Man, that I almost think that if you're Vegas, you know, I've heard it said a couple of different places, and I don't know if you actually got a chance to look at this, but I did a quick mock draft of who I would pick based on the cap friendly tool, and you know what, like I just went through and took, you know, best player available, and there's some pretty good, you know, utility players on here that I think if I'm Vegas, just taking the best player available and flipping for future assets. Man, you're not doing too bad,
and,
you know?
You know, and I'd certainly believe that that's, you know, potentially something that could happen with Fleury as well, is that, you know, the Vegas gets him for free and then turns around and, you know, converts him into a second-round pick or something like that. I mean, there's a couple of teams. One of the most outlandish, like, theories that I've seen, but it actually kind of makes sense to me, is what if a team like Philly used Vegas as a proxy to get Marc-Andre Fleury?
You know, I mean, we did take Mark Streit from them
We certainly, you know, kind of pulled the wool over their eyes. You know, they were paying half of his salary while he was, you know, lifting the cup in Nashville on Sunday night.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if something like that happens. I don't want something like that to happen, but I also, you know, recognize that that's part of the gamble, no pun intended, this expansion draft.
Know, and I look at that team, you know, I look at the Flyers and say, well, I mean, their defense is still pretty bad, but, I mean, they have some forward talent. You know, that's a team that kind of just missed the playoffs and got pretty uninspired goaltending. So, you know, I don't know. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I find it more likely that if Fleury doesn't go straight to Vegas and stay in Vegas, it's a bad pun. It's not a pun. but I think,
that was terrible.
You know, but I do look at a team like Calgary or maybe Winnipeg. You know, I think those are probably the two best fit markets for him at this time.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be surprised if either one of them ends up, if he ends up there via proxy.
Yeah, definitely.
So let's talk expansion draft. And I'm going to start here because, I mean, this has been kind of the furthest thing from my mind other than the Fleury-Murray debacle for the past, you know, 12 months. But if you are Jim Rutherford, how do you go about this expansion draft?
Well, this is a big challenge, you know, and I think I think a lot of Pens fans and a lot of people kind of looking at the Penguins situation, it's, you know, it all kind of ebbs around whatever happens with Marc-Andre Fleury. You know, and I think because truly the Penguins are in a position that if Fleury isn't the pick, they're still going to lose a very good player.
Right.
You know, and there's kind of no easy way to do it, I would say. You know, I think we actually did vary in our approaches. I think you went with the seven forwards and three defensemen, and I went with the eight skaters total in our lists.
That is true.
You know, because it's kind of like, well, what are you willing to sacrifice?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question. I'm happy to start here so people can begin by flaming me for this. But I did go with the 7-3 model, and so you know, just off the top, you have to protect Crosby, Malkin, Kessel, and Letang. So that's, you know, three and one. But my other protections were Patrick Hornquist, Brian Rust, Oscar Sundquist, and Tommy Kuhnhackl, and then Olli Maatta and Justin Schultz and Matt Murray were my other, I guess, six skaters. And so let me just give my justification for this before Twitter annihilates me. So as I went through and looked at, you know, who was going, I think I went by a couple assumptions. One, I went by the assumption that Nick Bonino is going to get paid somewhere, and that's just money that I don't think the Pens need to spend on Nick Bonino. And again, that's not to say that I think Nick Bonino is a bad player. I don't think so. I think that they can find what he does somewhere else that's not going to cost them $5.5 million a year. And I realize that, you know, that, what is it, $1.7 million contract that he's on is a really good-looking contract. But I still think you could find, you know, that third-line center for more like $3.5 or $4 million as opposed to, you know, probably what he's going to get paid. I mean, I look at what, and I just say that because I look at what Justin Williams gets paid to be, you know, Mr. Game 7 big performer for about the same thing as, like, I would say less contribution than what Nick Bonino puts up, because he's, you know, they score maybe close-ish to the same amount of points, but Nick Bonino kills penalties and is used in that defensive shutdown role, whereas Justin Williams is not doing that. So I think Bonino's going to get paid somewhere. I think Daly is also going to get paid somewhere. So that's why, you know, I didn't look at those guys as being people that I wanted to protect. Brian Rust, I think, has become one of the heartbeats to this Penguins club, and Patrick Hornquist might be the other one. You know, those guys, it just, you know, I've just seen it time and time again where the Pens will come out flat except for 72 and 17, and they'll come out gunning for people and just, you know, they get it, they stick to the process, and they go for it. And I just love that. Like, I love the moxie that those guys bring to the lineup night in and night out. And I want to continue to see them be Pittsburgh Penguins. I think the Pens are in a sticky situation with Oscar Sundquist because he is eligible to be expansion drafted. And I don't want to see him do that. I think the kid's got a really bright future in Pittsburgh. I think my hope is that, and I get the sense some, depending like on which news source you read, but I get the sense that this is how, the Pens management is looking at him, that he's going to step in and fill the role that Nick Bonino has been playing in. Now, whether or not he can do that, you know, that's a question mark, but I chose to keep him around because I think he found a scoring touch a little bit in the AHL this year. You know, you're not going to be looking for him to put up 60 points, but if he can bump in, you know, 35, 45 points, you know, in kill penalties and play smart hockey that's north-south, I think, you know, I heard nothing but good things out of Clark Donatelli, who's the Wilkes-Barre Pens coach, about Oscar Sundquist. So I decided to keep him. And then I decided to keep Tommy Kuhnhackl around. It was a toss-up for me between him and Scott Wilson, and I decided to keep Tommy Kuhnhackl because he can come out and kill penalties. It seems like Sullivan trusts him, even though that he was, I assume, was hurt. That's what they kept saying on a bunch of the different broadcasts, that Kuhnhackl was hurt with something. I haven't heard what that is, but I think that would change if he was just a healthy scratch. I think that would change for me. I'm not sure to what, but assuming that he was hurt, keep him around again, because that means that the Pens penalty killing has been really, really good. I think they're going to have to fill it out next year, especially if Matt Cullen and Chris Kunitz aren't back. And if, you know, potentially Carl Hagelin gets expansion drafted, but You know, that's neither here nor there. And then Mata and Schultz, I think you have two guys that are young, that can move the puck and be heady hockey players when they want to. I saw that as a no-brainer for me. I think what hurt was, as I was looking at it, man, I had a hard time not putting a check mark next to Ian Cole's name. I think the world of this guy. And especially coming off of like various points over the past two seasons where, you know, he's been a healthy scratch and he's been, you know, just played, you know, atrociously. I mean, when the dude's played good hockey, you know, we've talked about him as a potential, you know, number two defenseman alongside of Chris Letang. You can't say enough about how good he was with Justin Schultz over the past 2 years. But at the end of the day, I think it's something that his skill set is something that you can go out and replace in free agency coming next year. And if he doesn't get drafted, then great. Like, I would love to see him in a Penn sweater for a really, really long time. But if not. But, yeah. So, I don't know. Those are some of my thoughts.
Well, I appreciate all of that. You know, I think there's nothing wrong with pretty much any of those picks. I mean, I think, and we'll see this in my list in a moment, but it's like, I would find it really, really hard to not hold on to Brian Dumoulin. This is probably recency bias, but like literally, from games 4 through 6 of the Stanley Cup final, like, I mean, he was probably top 4 Penguins player on the ice, like throughout, and you know, and I think that says a lot.
Yeah.
but it's funny though, because I've seen a lot of people, kind of siding with you, just kind of saying like, well, you know, what does Dumoulin actually like excel at? And I think that's a hard thing to kind of pinpoint. And I think that,
yeah, but that's not what makes him good. Yeah. You know, like, he's not the guy that's going to go out and like be Chris Letang that can be elusive and skate, or he's not the defensive powerhouse, or he's not this, that, or the other. He's just really good at
everything. It's, you know, I've used the analogy multiple times, but he's kind of like a younger version of Paul Martin. But I do think that kind of, skill set can be a little bit fleeting. And I think that's what I think a number of people are concerned about, you know, and I think you've even seen that in Paul Martin, who's, you know, he's 36 or whatever now, which, I mean, is a decade older than Dumoulin, but, you know, it kind of feels like, you know, making almost $5 million a year, he might be, you know, a little overpriced.
Right.
But so, for my protected list, similarly, obviously, Crosby, Malkin, Kessel, Letang, you know, they all have no movement clauses. I don't know why any team would ever want to move any of those guys, unless you're Toronto, right, and you're rebuilding and you have to get rid of Kessel because he's keeping your team from actually reaching bottom, as has been discussed already.
Right.
Then the rest of my list is Brian Rust, Brian Dumoulin, Justin Schultz, Olli Maatta, and Matt Murray. So, you know, I think kind of the thing to note with this is that I'm pretty conspicuously leaving Patrick Hornquist and Carl Hagelin as potential people that could be picked up. And I'm going to start with that logic and then maybe work my way back through. So the thing that I fear with a guy like Hornquist is, so he has 1 year remaining on his current deal, which I almost think might deter Vegas from being that interested in him, even if he were exposed, because, he's got 1 year and then he's probably going to go to free agency. I don't think there's any question about that. And the other side to that is that he is 30 years old now. I feel like that's always one of the toughest kind of players to get an appropriate value on and to actually, you know, kind of price them appropriately, especially with a guy like Hornquist who plays so physical and, you know, we kind of expect that his skills might erode a little bit earlier in his career than, you know, maybe a more like finesse style player. And I just feel like if you leave Hornquist unprotected, like, yeah, you're losing a really, really good player. I mean, obviously, game 7 hero, or Game 6 hero.
Right.
You know, but he's also, it also could save you some headaches down the road, I kind of believe. You know, and it's like, maybe it's like a 1 year kind of transfer that you execute, and then you can be like, yeah, okay, you know, now that you're a free agent, you want to come back here? You know, but I also just, and if I'm the Penguins, I'm just afraid that I'm going to get into a position where, like, you know, I'm going to be kind of forced, if we keep Hornquist, that, you know, I'm going to have to pay this guy $6 million a year for 6 years to keep him beyond this season. And to me, I don't, you know, I'd almost rather cut ties a year too early than get roped into a deal such as that. And that's kind of the same logic that I have with Carl Hagelin. You know, he's a guy that I think I heard earlier this postseason that, like, since he entered the league, he's played more postseason games than any other player. With his time with the Rangers and making a couple deep runs with them, and now obviously in the last couple years, all the extra games he's racked up here, you know, and he is just kind of an example. Like, I'm not saying he's the same at all, but, you know, you look at a guy kind of like Mason Raymond, who, you know, once upon a time was a pretty consistent 20 to 25 goal scorer, maybe around 50 points, who was just, everything he did was predicated on his speed. And, like, he turned, like, 31, and all of a sudden, you know, is literally, the wheels literally fell off. you know, and I kind of fear that, you know, as Hagelin plays more and more, that's kind of the risk that you run. I mean, it's not to use, like, a, you know, mixed sport allegory, but they say that a lot about, like, running backs in the NFL now. It's like, well, you can't commit to them too long because, you know, if they're any good, you're going to run them into the ground pretty soon. You know, and yeah. I kind of fear that the things that Hagelin predicates his game on are those kinds of fleeting talents that might not be with him when he's, you know, 32 or whatever. You know, so if they want to take a guy like that, more power to him. You know, and then moving on from that, it's, you know, as you were saying about Brian Rust, you know, I feel like he's probably, at least in terms of eligible for the expansion draft players, like, you know, he's one of those most impactful forwards we have. You know, he might not always put up, you know, gaudy point totals, you know, but he does his job and he does it well, and there's a lot to be said for that. And then obviously, as I've kind of already labored on with Brian Dumoulin, like, you know, to me, that's a guy that you can lose him and you'll notice it. I mean, in the same way that the Penguins kind of had a problem filling, you know, Paul Martin's absence the first year after he left. And similarly, you know, when Sergei Gonchar left in 2010, you know, I think it's, you know, you might not necessarily notice it in terms of points or production, but all of a sudden you're going to be like, you know what, this was a guy that could eat 24 minutes a night comfortably, you know, contributes on the penalty kill, you know, can skate with a guy like Chris Letang. You know, that's a really important piece to me. And then Schultz, if they don't have a contract to him, like, tomorrow, I'm going to be disappointed. And, yeah, you know, in Mata, you know, I think you could make a kind of a case that maybe it's not worth protecting Mata. You know, maybe you would protect Ian Cole and just see if they would want to bite on, you know, Mata's over $4 million a year contract and say, well, you know, he's still only 23. You know, and I think there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, I'm not about to abandon ship on him. You know, I think this year, after some mid-season, you know, health issues, which is kind of nothing uncommon, hopefully he'll actually have a legit off-season to, like, rest, recover, and hopefully get a little bit healthier.
Yeah, you know, the more that I look at the list, the more that I'm convinced by it. Just two thoughts, I think, or, well, one thought. I think it's interesting that both of us left Carl Hagelin off of our lists. I think that that's just an interesting, you know, little something there that tells you. And again, it's not that he doesn't add value to the team. It's just that when we're thinking about who you know, who is successful versus who is necessary. I mean, the Pens won a whole bunch of games without him this year. And I would love to have him there, but, like, you also just can't afford to be paying $4 million to a guy who's going to score less than 30 points.
Well, exactly. I mean, and, you know, and maybe that's a little bit of a recency bias. You know, this is a guy that's, you know, consistently put up, you know, somewhere in that 40 to 45 range, you know, and this year just had a bad year and was hurt for some of it. But again, it's like you kind of look at a guy like Josh Archibald and say, well, hey, he skates pretty similar. You know, he's a right-handed shot as opposed to a left, but, you know, maybe there's something there and we can pay Archibald, you know, $800,000 or something.
Right. Yeah, it'll be interesting. I think, I don't know that Jim Rutherford can do a whole lot that's going to surprise me with whatever list he submits.
No, we know that one way or another, whether you decide to kind of overload your protections on the forwards or if you overload your protections on the defense, like, that's still going to leave a pretty good player out there.
Right.
You know, I think kind of to me the most interesting one could be Mata. You know, I think there's a real notion, and I feel like a couple of people have reported on this, like, during the season that, you know, maybe the Penguins were leaning towards trying to kind of, you know, leave him on, you know, as bait.
Yeah. Well, I mean, hey, he just won a second Stanley Cup in, in his many years, and there's nothing that looks good to another team absolutely. Like Stanley Cups.
You know, and, you know, I really like Olli Maatta. I still really like Olli Maatta, but just have to, you know, but I also just think that there's some other potential, you know, if you want to get back to that speed model, you know, I certainly feel like losing the slowest player on your team is probably a good way to work towards that end.
Yeah, it's true. That's true. This just gets me excited to talk about the free agency coming up. That's gotta not press forward into that. Okay, so we'll close with this because we're already running a little short on time here. So just real quickly, I want to run through, and this will be the last thing that we talk about today. But what in each of the team or in each of the divisions out or that's not the Penguins, what is the most interesting team for you, and what do they do, or what do they not do coming up?
I'm gonna start with this one because it's been, you know, this is kind of like a where there's smoke, there's sometimes fire scenario. But the two of the teams that I'm most drawn to that are probably going to pay a very dear price could be Tampa and Anaheim. So Tampa has like 8 forwards that they would want to protect. And the worst part is they only have 2 defensemen that they would want to protect. But it doesn't work like that. So basically the situation they're faced with, they have to protect Steven Stamkos, Ryan Callahan, and Victor Hedman.
That Callahan contract is so bad.
He makes like 6.5 or something. Like, it's silly.
I know he does.
For like 15 goals. Like, I mean, I shouldn't qualify all productivity, like, in the sense of, you know, goals, assists, whatever, but I mean, he's not like a particularly strong possession driver. He's fairly injury prone. I don't know. That's not a good contract. But anyway,
leaves
Nikita Kucherov, Alex Killorn, Vladislav Namestnikov, Jonathan Drouin, Andre Palat, Tyler Johnson, and Anton Strahlman as players that still need to be protected. And then they'll have to choose between either Jason Garrison or Braden Coburn as their final defenseman. But so what a lot of people are thinking is maybe what Tampa has to do is make a deal with Anaheim. So Anaheim's also in a bind. So they have to protect Corey Perry, Ryan Getzlaff, Ryan Kessler, and Kevin Bieksa. Another just like, what were you thinking kind of move? It's so bad. But so then that leaves Sami Vatanen, Cam Fowler, Richard Rakell, Jakob Silverberg, Andrew Cogliano, and what's their other defenseman?
Hampus Lindholm and Josh Manson.
Hampus Lindholm, who's probably their best defenseman. Sorry, I forgot his name. But because I always want to like call him Elias Lindholm of
right, yeah of definitely the Hurricanes. Not.
But that's besides the point. Yeah, and Josh Manson as well, who's a very young and very talented defenseman in his own right. So what might have to happen is, you know, for each of those teams, maybe Anaheim ships a defenseman to Tampa, and Tampa sends a forward to Anaheim, and, you know, we'll see what happens. I think the names most commonly associated have been, like, Sammy Vatanen and maybe Jonathan Drouin, but because I think Drouin's due for a big raise because he's a restricted free agent at the end of his ELC now. Yeah, so that's a tough one.
I still don't like that dude.
Yeah, so that's definitely a challenge. Then just real briefly, I think from the Metropolitan Division, if you don't count the Penguins, I think Columbus is in a world of hurt. They have to protect Brandon Dubinsky, Nick Foligno, and Scott Hartnell. And I did see from Aaron Portsline, who writes for Columbus Dispatch, that they apparently did not ask Hartnell to waive his no movement clause, which does not make any sense.
Man, that's a those are probably, like, you know, I'm looking at the show notes here, and I see that you have it broken down into the must protect list and the need to protect list. And when I looked at the Columbus section that you had written, I thought that was the must protect. I flipped them and then realized, oh wait, nope. This is the wrong way. They have to protect Brandon Dubinsky, Nick Foligno, and Scott Hartnell, which are just not the three guys that I would want to protect.
No, I would literally prefer to protect every other player on this list, which is Brandon Saad, Cam Atkinson, Boone Jenner, Alex Wenberg, William Karlsson, Josh Anderson, Lucas Sedlak, Seth Jones, David Savard, Ryan Murray, and, well, maybe I wouldn't actually more want to protect Jack Johnson, but that's besides the point. Yeah, so
So
you're looking at, you know, probably realistically speaking, probably like Karlsson, Anderson, or Sedlak being available. You know, all of whom are like probably 25 or less in age and like capable of, you know, probably 50-ish points on a season.
Man, that's a good player to lose for nothing.
Yeah, so that's bad. And then I feel like this is actually the worst example. So my last kind of last division is the Central, and Minnesota has to protect 32-year-old Zach Parise, 34-year-old Mikko Koivu, 34-year-old Jason Pominville, and 32-year-old Ryan Suter. And then that will leave some combination of Jared Spurgeon, Jonas Brodin, Marco Scandella, Matt Dumba, Charlie Coyle, Jason Zucker, Marcus Grajovac, Eric Halla, Michael Granlin, and Nino Niederreiter available. Like, probably like three of those players will be available.
Oh, man. Well, and that's, you know,
that's called prioritizing the wrong people.
Yeah, that's, man, Chuck Fletcher just harpooned that franchise for a while.
They've never been close. You know, I mean, I remember being, you know, super captivated when Parise and Suter were hitting the market, you know, but I mean, that team, like that franchise just literally just bent over backwards four times to give them so much more than they probably needed to. And, you know, now they're going to have to deal with it when, you know, one of those excellent defensemen walks away.
Man, I don't even know what to say. If you're a Minnesota fan and you're listening to this, I'm sorry. That's all I can say. Because, I mean, there's so much young talent on that list that is going to end up being moved. And you know what? Like, this is nothing to say, like, you know, some of these teams could get skittish and start scrambling in order to protect the right people and, you know, maybe get forced into doing the, you know, some type of trade or something else like that. And, man, you just hope that, you know, I try to actively not root against teams because I don't think it's good sportsmanship. It's one thing to, you know, cheer for a team, but to root against a team, I think it's just bad sportsmanship. But man, it's just, it's hard to like the administration of this franchise, because man, they've just shot themselves in the foot leaving all of these good young players open like that.
Yeah, because I mean, it's basically, you know, so they already have, you know, three forwards committed, so they could either only protect one of the, like, the literally six forwards that I listed to save most of their defensemen, but not all, because, like, I listed five defensemen.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, good on you for doing a fine job of drafting, but, like, you know, that's going to hurt.
Yeah, I, you know, as I was looking through these and I did a little cheating and looked at your list, I found myself agreeing with you a lot. Like, these teams are, they're hurting for certain, but I just for the sake of being a little bit different, here are some other thoughts to consider. I was thinking, you know, in the Metro, Columbus is going to lose a really good player. But I also just think that it's, you know, New York, the Rangers are going to lose Antti Raanta. Unless they decide to trade him beforehand, which I don't know, you know, how they would pull off something like that. But, you know, that sucks for them because, like, you know, we might be seeing the end of Henrik Lundqvist as, like, an elite goaltender in the NHL. And, you know, Antti Raanta has proved that he can carry a team like the Rangers that, you know, get shelled night in and night out. And to lose him for nothing is just tough. So I feel bad for them, but at the same time, they're in the Metro, so I don't feel that bad.
Fair enough.
I think looking at the Atlantic, I noticed that, you know, Florida's quietly built a somewhat impressive defense corps with, you know, Ekblad, and you have Jason Demers, who's not bad. Keith Yandel's down there. I mean, not a bad defense corps, but the way that it shakes out, one of their young defensemen, or at least a good defenseman down there, is gonna be lost to this trade, and either that or they're gonna lose one of their good young forwards. It's just gonna be, they just have a glut of young talent, which you would hope, for as bad as they were, for as long as they were, that they would have a glut of young talent. But I mean, they're gonna lose a good player, and man, that's a shame, because that club plays exciting hockey. You just want to see him. You want to see him score goals. You want to see him, you know, get excited, and it's just tough to lose, you know, a good young player there. I think, again, just for the sake of being contrarian to what you just did, seeing the Stan Bowman circus that comes about every offseason is entertaining to me. I just heard that. You know, there's a whole lot of rumors flying around that potentially piece of the Chicago core is going to be moved, and you know, that would be exciting for me, because I think that screams of, you know, desperation. I'm okay with that.
The only problem is it's probably going to be,
or Brent, you know, they're going to end up,
who's like, I mean, yes, he is a part of that core, but like, he's not that good.
Well, I mean, I think he's a decent defenseman, that's for sure, but he is not Duncan Keith, and but they're going to lose a good, somebody good, you know, and the more that I think about it, the more I think they might end up flipping him, and that other team might get fleeced, because it's going to be the Blackhawk effect, where, you know, a player plays really good on that team because they have a really good team, and then it goes somewhere else and just is not the same player, you know, hint, Andrew Ladd, but, you know, whatever. Again, not my problem. just straight up, not my problem. And then, you know, in the Pacific Division, Anaheim, they're gonna lose somebody that's a really, really talented. And I've been hearing that it's either Jakob Silverberg or Rickard Rakell. And both of those kids are, man, those are talented hockey players. And you hate to see them, you know, leave a team like Anaheim and somebody like, you know, like Corey Perry has to stick around in that city. Kevin Bieksa. Like, you know, at the expense of, like, a talent who's young and fast and exciting. I mean, it just hurts me to see, like, these other young prospects that are going to go off somewhere else and, you know, their development right when they should be kind of peeking into the into their prime and kind of launching up to that next plateau are going to end up in a franchise that's just not good. and you know, be asked to carry a team, and it's just, you just hope that it doesn't ruin any careers or potential, absolutely. You know.
Especially dealing with Randy Carlyle as the coach, too.
Yeah. What a... as a side note, when I went through, I took some time and went through and did my own expansion draft just to see, like, what would come out and what would happen. And I'll say this. It was not... It's not a terrible team. Like, it's not going to be a... barely floating above 40 points for the season kind of team. It's going to be a decent team, depending on, you know, what happens and how things shake out. But I think it's going to be a pretty decent team, and I think they're going to come out of it with a right good number of either prospects or draft picks in the next couple of years as well.
Yeah, and that's just going to be such a big key. You know, I really hope that that is what Vegas is planning on, and I think they are. I mean, by all accounts, that's what they're doing. You know, but I feel like they need, you know, they really need to pick players that could almost be more meaningful or more valuable to another team, and then be able to use those players to turn it into first round picks or to actually address a need as you start to develop, you know, and kind of see what your team is up to. So, yeah, it'll be exciting. I mean,
It will be interesting. I mean, just for the timeline, expansion sheets are due, or I guess like expansion protection lists are due this weekend on Saturday. And then the draft is next Wednesday, but in the meantime, there's that weird free agency period where Vegas can choose to sign pending free agents.
Yeah, you know, there's probably a few guys out there that might make sense for them that, you know, don't otherwise have a contract. Like, the only thing is, like, I don't really understand what would stop Vegas from, like, using that window to say, okay, you know, we want to bring you in and we're going to pay you more than anybody else on the open market. But we're not going to make this official until, like, actual free agency opens up. And we're still going to take somebody else from your team, and then we'll sign you on July 1st.
Well, I mean, it just depends on, you know, what that player's thinking. Like, if that player decides to say, like, hey, you know, maybe the deal goes down that the offer is for, you know, we'll just say for, we'll take a player like Nick Bonino, right? So Vegas says, hey, we can give you, you know, $4 million a year if we take you during this window, or we'll give you $5.5 million if you let us take you, you know, during the actual free agency window, because we want to take somebody else from the Penguins. You know, I mean, like, maybe something like that happens and the player agrees not to sign with, you know, X other team for that amount of money in the process, or in the meantime, because they know that they can get a significant amount more somewhere else.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, I don't know. That actually sounds pretty good. I mean, in some ways, I hope that happens. Like, I don't want Vegas to necessarily, like, abuse that rule. But on the other hand, it's like, that would be kind of cool if they, you know, if they can actually build a more competitive team via, you know, kind of backroom deals than, you know, just picking and flipping or whatever the case may be.
Well, I mean, I don't think George McPhee is a dummy, so I think he'll do something. So I'm just excited. There's going to be some fireworks that happen over the next week, and I'm really excited to see what they are. Well, cool, man. I think we've about run out of time for this show. So do you have any other closing thoughts that we want to leave people with today?
You know, I just want to thank everybody that's been tuning in, you know, kind of since we got back in the groove. I am happy to report that the podcast, you can now find it on iTunes. You know, took a little while. Partially my fault, partially just not paying attention to things going on. But yeah, it's available now. You know, probably as I'm sharing links for this episode, you know, I'll probably just link it directly to the iTunes page. So you'll be able to find it. You know, we appreciate if you add us to your weekly feed. And yeah. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, right on. Well, for Andrew Roman, I am Mike Swanson, and this has been the Reggie's House Podcast. We are so thankful that you guys listen to us, and feel free to reach out. With that said, let's go Pens. Come back at it in 2017.
For the three-peat.
That's all I'm talking about.
Bye.
Peace. Thank you.